Good morning, everyone. Good morning. To those of you in the room and those of you who are at home. It's great to be here, and it's great to be able to spend some time back in the book of Exodus. If we go to our first screen, if you are joining us for the first time, we are looking at Exodus, and the young adults and the youth watched Prince of Egypt the other night, and we've been looking at this not just as some historical book, but as our salvation story. And we pointed out all along the way that this is the book of Exodus framed Jesus' life and ministry from beginning to end. And because we are Christ's disciples, this is a book and a story that should frame our ministry, our stories and our lives as well. And today I want us to focus on that question that Brad's already raised for us. It comes out of today's reading in verse 7. Is the Lord among us or not? And I want us to focus on that word us, because we live in this very individualistic age. And a lot of the times when we're talking about God, it's about, is God with me? And where is God in my life? But I don't know if you're aware, but throughout most of the Bible, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, God writes and addresses his people. We don't have a singular and plural form of you. We just have the same word. But most of the yous in the Bible are addressed to plural yous. And this is a question about God being among us. Remember, Jesus said, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am with them. Now, this is not to say that God doesn't meet with us individually. Of course, he does. But the focus of today really has a lot to do with God's presence with his people, as his people, and that's what we're going to focus on. Now, I'm going to talk to you about these pictures. I'm not going to speak to them now. You can just have a peek, and I'm going to come back to them. But the last time our preaching team met, we discussed the fact that if Exodus is our salvation story, it would be really good to integrate our own personal stories and show how these things, how this book really does frame our lives. And so at the end, I want to tell you about these stories. When I was going through my notes the last time I preached on this, these two pictures were very directly related. So I'll come back to those at the end. But for those of you who need a little bit of review, we are in an interesting section, because the previous section I would have called the deliverance section. So we know that, you know, God had sent the plagues on Egypt, and then finally there was the Passover, and then there was this moment where the Israelites arrived at the Red Sea, and they had the Egyptian army bearing down behind them, and they cried out, and God, you know, used the staff that Moses had in his hand, and the waters opened up, and Israel went through, and then God closed the waters over the Egyptians, and Israel was saved. And we're told at that moment that the Israelites put their faith in the Lord, and they put their faith in his servant Moses. And you're thinking, yay, these people are becoming faithful. And then Jono and Erica helpfully took us through the very next thing that happens. On the other side of the Red Sea, the Israelites sing this salvation song and, you know, sing to the Lord. He is triumph. The horse and rider, he's thrown into the sea. The Lord is my salvation. And so there's singing, they're worshiping. And we heard why, you know, we need to continue to remember and to sing our worship songs and our songs of thanksgiving. And so it seems like these are really becoming the people of God. But then, two chapters ago from today, if you were listening to today's reading saying, it sounds exactly like the reading from a couple of weeks ago, well, that's exactly right. The very next thing that happens, just a couple of verses after their salvation song, we enter into this testing and grumbling section. And so it's very clear that God is testing these people to see if they will be faithful. And over again, the Israelites fail the test, and they grumble. And so back in chapter 15, they grumble because they didn't have any water, and they grumble against Moses. And so, yeah, you've gone from they put their trust in Moses, and they put their trust in God, and the Lord is my salvation, to what do we have to drink? And they're grumbling against God and they're grumbling against Moses. And so then we talked about this cycle that happens, and it just happens over and over again. God sends a test to Israel. Israel complains to Moses. Moses cries out to God, what am I supposed to do with these people? And God responds. So a couple of chapters ago, the water was bitter and the people were bitter, and God, you know, caused this tree or this wood, and he threw it into the water and the water became drinkable. And then he led them to some springs of water and some palm trees, and they sat underneath them and had all the water that they needed to drink. And then this is a cycle that happens again and again. But then that leads us to today's reading. And it will sound very similar. So, from verse 1 of chapter 17, the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded, and they camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Once again, so they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" You see this irony? God puts them to the test. They put the Lord to the test. Grumbling against Moses is really grumbling against God. But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. And they said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt and make us and our children, our livestock, die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." It's worth talking about that last phrase, because if I were to say that today, you know, I'm having an argument with my family and I say, "Oh, they're almost ready to stone me," you know that I'm just speaking in hyperbole, right? It's just an exaggeration. One of the things we need to realize, we're in this section, this testing section. This group of people has not arrived at Mount Sinai. They have not been given the law. This is a lawless group of people. So let me just take you back, okay? Forget everything you know about what might happen today, okay? That these are a people without any law to govern them. They have never been a nation before. They have no processes and procedures to fall back on them. They are a group of rabble, a group of slaves who've just done what they've been told. Now they're free and they're out in the desert. But in some ways, they are more dangerous to themselves than they have ever been. This is a very dangerous time. And so they get out in the middle of the wilderness, and you know, there's not any international community to police what's going to go on. And we know that throughout history, even going into Jesus' day, when the people in a crowd decided someone had sinned, they just picked up stones and they would stone people to death. And who's gonna complain? There's no law, you know. There's no international community that's gonna come in and say, "Oh, how dare you do that?" You know, and you're an international desert or whatever. No one cares. They can do whatever they want. When I don't know if any of you remember the L.A. riots, but this is what happened back in the days when there was a guy by the name of Rodney King. Some police beat him to death. It's something that's becoming all too familiar in the U.S. And it's interesting because Parisa and I were living in California where this was happening. But in 1992, we had come back to Australia for a visit. And so we were sitting here watching this riot unfold in our home state and watching everything on television the way that other people were watching it in kind of disbelief. And the city turned to chaos. And later on, they went and interviewed. And even while it was happening, they interviewed a lot of the people, these gang members. And what happened is chaos was breaking out, but the gangs of Los Angeles basically encircled the city. They used cars. They, you know, burned out cars. They blocked off streets. No police, no ambulance, nothing could come in. Even sometimes when news helicopters would fly down, people would shoot at the helicopters, and the gang said, "We have taken over Los Angeles," and no one could get in. And they beat people to death. They looted stores. They cause absolute destruction. It's what happens when people descend into chaos, when there is lawlessness. So when Moses says they're about ready to stone me, he's not speaking in hyperbole or exaggeration. He knew that he was in real trouble. And so the Lord answered Moses, go out in front of the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff which you struck the Nile, and go, and I will stand before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and the water will come out for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders and Israel. This brings us back to our big question for today. Is the Lord among us or not? Because in verse 7 it says, he called the place Massa, which means the place of testing. And he also called it Meribah, which means the place of grumbling, right? The two themes, testing and grumbling. Massa and Meribah, because there the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? I want us to notice this question, is the Lord among us or not? When Jesus arrives 1,500 years later and the Israelites have entered into the land, the name that he is given from birth is Emmanuel, which means God is with us. And one of the really big questions is, who is this guy? But we're now in a pre-law, pre-religion group of Israelites, okay? When they get to Sinai, now they're going to be given instructions about how to build a tabernacle and how to get priests and all of these things. And eventually, when the tabernacle, when this tent is built, it will sit in the middle of the Israelite camp, and the Israelites will camp around it, and God's glory will descend upon that tabernacle, and they will know that God is in their midst. But right now, they seem to be a little bit confused. Later on, John will tell us that Jesus came and he built his tabernacle among us. In other words, he took on flesh and he lived among us. But a lot of the people, when they watched the things that he was doing, kept on saying, who is this guy? Where did he come from? It's the same question. Is the Lord really among us or not? And I'm not sure if you're aware, but we, a couple weeks ago, talked about how God provided manna in the wilderness when they had complained about food. And we saw how Jesus then took up that symbol when he had fed the Israelites in the wilderness with the bread. And then they came back and said, can we have some more bread? And he said, the bread you're looking for is going to perish just like the manna, you know, perished. But the bread that has come from heaven, the true bread, will not perish and will give you eternal life. And he said, I am the bread of life. Well, Paul picks up the same sort of imagery in 1 Corinthians talking about the water. As I said, this book frames Jesus' life from beginning to end. So from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, reading from verse 1, I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud and they all passed through the sea and they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they all ate the same spiritual food, the manna, and they drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with them, and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So in the same way that the bread from heaven, in the same way that the bread was a symbol of Christ, so the water is also a symbol of Christ. But earthly bread and earthly water is good for a moment, but the eternal bread and the eternal water is good for all eternity. And so this kind of reminds us of a conversation that Jesus had with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." In the same way that Moses had provided that water in the wilderness, you know, miraculously, now Jesus says to this woman, "I can give you living water." And what's interesting about this is if you go over to John's gospel again, John chapter 7, I just want to read to you from verse 37. "On the last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, 'Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them.' By this he meant the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were later to receive. Up to that time, the Spirit had not been given, since Jesus had not yet been glorified." Now, we're told that these are things that Jesus said at the festival. And what is the festival? Well, it's a Jewish festival season, a feast that leads up to the Passover, where the Israelites have this whole week where they rehearse the things that happened in the wilderness. And so, you know, they lived out in the wilderness, and so they built tabernacles and all of these different kind of things, and they had all of these ways of remembering. Remember how God kept providing in the wilderness for the people. And so while they're sitting there in the middle of the festival and they're remembering how God provided manna from heaven and he provided rock from the water, Jesus stands in the middle of them and says, "Anyone who believes in me, streams of living water will flow from me to you." And he's talking about the things that will happen through his own death and his resurrection and through the coming of the Holy Spirit. All of this stuff is being fulfilled in Christ. But then this leads us to this second section, because it's a really interesting thing. The Israelites seem to be failing in a lot of the internal challenges. They're hungry and they're thirsty, and they grumble from within. And so it seems like God sends them a challenge from without. Suddenly, the Amalekites, this other nation, is going to attack them. And this is going to be a real sink or swim moment. Are they going to band together? Are they going to pray? Are they going to trust God? Or is this army going to wipe them out? And so we hear from verse 8 of today's reading, "The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose some of our men and go out and fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand.'" And so I want us to remember when we were back in Exodus 13 and the Israelites were told left Egypt armed for battle. But that was kind of ridiculous, because God said the first time that they face any kind of danger, they're going to turn tail and run. And that's why he led them on the way he did. But in the same way that God had rescued them from the hands of the Egyptians, he was the one who fought for them at the Red Sea. It was very clear that he was the one who was going to fight them. It wasn't about whether they had enough swords or ability. God was going to fight the battles for them. And so we're told, given this short description of this battle, but it's very powerful, from verse 10. "So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. And when Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and they put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekites with the sword. That's a funny story, isn't it? Not God saw the Amalekites and quickly sent them away. Or God just said, go out and have power and you will overcome the Amalekites. And they fought them bravely and they won. But for some reason, there's this whole thing of take the staff that you've used all along and stand on top of the hill where you can be seen and raise your arms up in the air towards heaven. And as you intercede and as you call out on me, I will empower you. And the Israelites will still fight. They have to fight, but they'll win. But when your arms drop, they're going to start losing. And so you have these other men who stand on either side, and they make sure that Moses can keep his hands held up. It's a really powerful story. It's really worth us reflecting on. God even says later, the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. And so, like with the Amalekite army or the things that Brad was sharing earlier, the challenges that he was facing at hands and feet or the various challenges that you are facing, why does God allow these? In fact, maybe why does God even send them? Why does he sometimes test us in our faith? And I want to make it very clear that we should always pray at all times, and you should pray about little things, and you should pray about big things. But it seems to me, and it seems pretty clear from the scriptures, that there are times that God puts a challenge in front of his people that is so big that they can only move it together through prayer. It's like there's this giant boulder in our path, and he says, it doesn't matter how hard you push, one of you is not going to move it, and it's not going to be moved with two or three or four, until all of you in the Lord's strength put your shoulder to the boulder, it's not going anywhere. And why? He doesn't say that people are going to know you're my disciples by how clever and how smart each and every one of you are. He says they will know you are my disciples by your love for one another, through your unity, and through your obedience. That's the whole thing. That's how we know that we are a people of God. When a challenge comes our way, and we band together in prayer, together, and overcome it, that's when the world looks on and says, hold on, what's happening over here? That's how people recognize that God really is among us. Which brings me back to these symbols. And I went back through my notes the last time I spoke on this, and I went, oh, wow. It's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. But back in 2011, I had been scheduled to preach on this passage, but I was doing so under a lot of duress and stress because a good friend of mine and a leader in our church had just had what he called a massive brain explosion, this aneurysm, that had left this, as he called it, a hole in his brain the size of a peach. He had a complete blowout. And the only thing they could do to help him was they put him in an induced coma. They cut off the top of his skull to relieve pressure. And they said to his family, look, we don't know whether he will live or die, but you need to face some facts that if he does live, he may not ever walk or talk or communicate again. And, you know, they began to wonder, should we just pray that God will be merciful and just let him die? Because this friend of mine was a creative back when there used to be a Disney Australia. He was the creative director for Disney Australia. He was this brilliant animator, and he made films, and he did all of these great things. And the whole thought of Ian, you know, living out his life, unable to speak, unable to communicate, that was just too sad. And they said, they called me up on the Saturday before the Sunday, and they said, Chad, will you please be praying? He's in an induced coma, and we don't know if he will ever come out. So here I am getting ready to preach on this exact same passage, and I was really struck by this symbol of Moses lifting up his arms to heaven and his assistants standing on either side, and how this whole thing came down to a spiritual exercise, and God was calling together his people and asking the question, is God among us or not? And so I remember standing there, and I finished preaching, and I said, I believe that God is calling us to pray for our brother Ian. And so I said, I want you to hold up your hands to heaven with me, and we're going to pray. And so we did a lot of what we do at the end of our services. We just had an open time of prayer. And people prayed, and they prayed, and they prayed. And I don't know if you've ever done this thing where you raise your hands for a little while, but after a couple of minutes, they start getting really tired. And I could see people out there, and their hands were shaking, and I looked down on the front row, and here was the daughter and the young family of this man who was in a coma, and tears were streaming down her face, but she had her hands in the air, and the whole place sat there for I don't know how long, but hands in the air and interceding for Ian. And so the service ended, and some days later I found myself in ICU because they said, we're going to bring him out of his coma today. So we sat there in the ICU, and Ian was brought out of the coma, and he had a hard time communicating. It was very hard for him to talk, but he was talking. And being who he is, he says so much just with his own face. And there were times we were sitting there in the ICU and we were actually laughing. And I became aware that all these other somber things were happening all around us. There were beds all through this. But there we were with Ian and we were beginning to laugh with him. And eventually he was released from ICU and I went to go visit him at home. And I said, what are you doing, Ian? And he said, oh, how the mighty have fallen. And he was still struggling to speak and to have full sentences. But he showed me on a piece of paper, he said, I'm drawing ovals today. I used to be creative director for Disney, but today I'm drawing ovals. And he showed me an A4 piece of paper and just over and over again, just like a kindy student would. And they weren't very good. They were all, you know, out of alignment and everything. But he said, I'm trying to learn to draw shapes again today. Still couldn't walk, still couldn't talk, but he was learning to draw shapes. And we continued to pray for Ian. And then sometime later, he turned up to my house, and he had this thing in his hand, and he said, I want you to open this. He said, this is a gift. It's a thank you. So I opened it up, and the picture that is on the bottom of the screen, he said, it's an oval. I've just filled in some of the details. And God had slowly but surely started giving him some of his creative skills back. And he is an animator to this very day. And later that year, when Parissa and I opened up one of our new shops up in Springwood, he said, I want to do your sign for you. And so he hand-painted that sign. And I remember him saying to me when we went out to lunch sometime later, he said, you know, my children have often struggled with church and they've struggled with religion and they often find it just to be a program. You know, you go into church, you sit down, you sing some songs and you go back out. They said they often ask, is God actually in this place? He said, but there are a handful of times when my kids have said, we know that God was present. And he said, I am so thankful because one of those times that they all talk about is the time that the church held their hands up to God and prayed. And they say, every day, Dad, we look at you and you are God's miracle. We know God is among us and God is with us. In a moment, we're going to have a chance to respond through prayer and worship, but we're going to sing a song to remind us of some of these things, and then we'll come and share in communion.
Our last song today will be, "Yet Not I, But Through Christ in Me." So let's stand and sing.
Oh yeah.